Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 720. My name is Camden Busey. I'm in Grays Lake, Illinois. And as usual, I'm excited and delighted to be back with another program. We've got a really fun conversation lined up. We have three guests on the program. Three. We're really rocking today. And let me introduce to you first, we have Douglas Clausen, who serves as Associate General Secretary for the OPC's Committee on Foreign Missions. He also serves as a member of the Board of Directors here at Reformed Forum, someone I just spent a couple of weeks with down in Colombia. Welcome back, Doug. It's good to see you today.
Glad to be here, Camden. Glad to be joining you in on this.
Yes, we're delighted to have you. So how are things going now back in the States for you? Are you reacclimated or have you already made another trip?
Well, I haven't even dug into some of that good Colombian coffee that we brought back with us, but I'm looking forward to that. Meetings this past week with men working for our various NAPARC churches in the area of foreign missions, executive directors for both diaconal international relief and also for foreign missions directors. That was the meetings this past week, and have a committee meeting next week.
Wow, lots going on, but wonderful things that are going on in the field, and we're thankful for your labors. I'm about 2.5 bags done into my coffee stash, so making 2 cappuccinos a day with my wife usually will knock that out pretty quickly. So we'll have to go back. You'll have to take me back so I can go get some more coffee. Anyway, we had a wonderful time, even got to go to a coffee cultivo on top of a mountain a mile high into the air. It was wonderful. So I'll never forget that. We also have with us today, Charles Jackson, who serves as an OPC foreign missionary, has served in Uganda for several years and is engaged in theological education there. Welcome to the program, Charles. It's good to see you.
Thank you. It's good to see you too.
Yes, it's a delight to have you on. I believe this is the first time on the program. So I'm excited to talk about missions with you and thankful that you could join us. Are you currently in Ohio?
I am. I'm recovering from neck surgery, so mm-hmm. as soon as I can get my neck moving a little better, I'll be heading back.
Yeah, wonderful, wonderful.
And by the way, we have great coffee in Uganda too.
So, you do. There's no doubt about it.
I can take you up to the mountain right behind us and show you coffee there. So you need.
I could come there as well. I'm just going to make my coffee world tour. Yes, I love it. And we also have with us Mike. I know his name, but we're just going to say Mike today, who's also served as a foreign missionary in Asia. And we're delighted to have him with us as well, taking some precautions for various reasons. But Mike, it's good to see you and speak with you today. We're not going to have you on video for those watching, but I know what you look like. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. My pleasure. I will say, don't come to Asia for coffee. Come for tea. I can fix you up with some pretty good tea.
We can take that too. Although I don't know if it's tea de coco, but we had some of that on top of a mountain as well for other reasons to deal with the altitude. But I look forward to that as well. We'll make it a trip. Doug, can you set this up? We'll go 3 countries and.
Hey, Bill, I've never had it, but he talks about this this tea that costs $100 US for a pot.
Mm.
Wow. Drinking a pot of tea for $100. Think about that.
That's a lot of money for tea.
Yeah.
My goodness. Well, today we're going to be speaking not only about foreign missions in general, but we're going to be speaking more specifically about global theological education. So each of the brothers with me today have engaged extensively in theological education in foreign mission fields, foreign from the perspective of North America and particularly the United States, of course. But we want to speak about not only the work of the OPC in foreign missions fields to raise up indigenous churches that would have that would be self-sufficient and one day eventually would send their own missionaries out into the field, but we're going to speak about the particular needs that different fields have and the particular efforts and initiatives that are underway to help raise up officers, particularly ministers, but also elders. And as well as lay people in a variety of cases. There's all sorts of education going on, and I'm delighted to speak about that with our guests today. A few things to mention. We are, of course, online at reformedforum.org. And I would encourage you to head on over to the archives. So you'll find just a couple weeks ago, Ryan Noah and I speaking about some of the material that I was able to teach in Colombia. And in that episode, we also provide an update as to Reformed Academy, which is an online initiative we have at our website, offering a variety of theological courses in video with translations, typically in Spanish and simplified Chinese, for free to anyone who can access the internet. So head on over to reformedforum.org, not only for the episode discussing those materials, but also the materials themselves. So Douglas, I was wondering if we could begin perhaps by offering a bit of a summary of the OPC's foreign missions philosophy, just kind of the work of foreign missions and how the OPC engages in that. There's a rich history because in many ways the OPC was founded over a specific church controversy regarding the work of foreign missions from the mainline Presbyterian Church and the decision to engage in work through the Independent Board for Presbyterian Foreign Missions, which eventually led to the defrocking of Machen and others because of their refusal to give up their Christian liberty and their refusal to partner in missions with people who did not believe that Jesus Christ was the only way to salvation. But in addition to that, just I think it would be helpful and people would be really excited to hear about how particularly ecclesiology fits with foreign missions, that we're not out to expand the OPC in some colonialistic fashion, but seeking to engage in the work of the Great Commission in a way that we believe is faithful to the whole counsel of God. So could you bring us up to speed a little bit and tell us a little bit about the work of the committee?
Well, it would be hard to go. Yes, I would be glad to do that. It would be hard to go back over the whole history of that. There, basically, in offering theological education, there'd be two, I would say, basic approaches. And one would be to work with the indigenous church, and the other is to work with institutions. So, for instance, some groups will go over, some organizations might go over, and they're working with a particular school, or they establish a particular school in a country or place, and they're working with that school and whatever students might come to that school. They might focus their work on working, you know, from a particular theological background or perspective, or with a particular indigenous church. But nevertheless, the orientation of their work is connected with that school, the one they've established or the one that's already there. The other approach is to work with the indigenous church and then see the work at a school or the establishment of a school as an outworking of working with that church. That doesn't mean that you're working only with that church. For instance, in Uganda, our work did start out primarily working with the pastors of one denomination, both men who are already in the pastoral ministry and men who are being prepared for the pastoral ministry. But then the work expanded beyond that. So it was working with the indigenous church, but then opening its doors and offering an education to anyone else who might like to come. I think, you know, you'll want to talk to Charles about this, but Charles has had, he's had a student who believes that he's an apostle. He's had a couple of prophets, you know.
Any teachers?
he's got one guy who's moved from pure Pentecostalism, and he's sort of like making that move toward Presbyterianism, so he calls himself a Presbycostal at this particular point.
Wow.
He's a great student. I've had him for a couple of classes myself. But nevertheless, the work that's there is focused on working with an indigenous church or maybe two indigenous churches of Reformed faith, you know, of like faith and practice. In other words, they're Presbyterian churches. They're churches that are committed to the Reformed faith, just like the OPC. And so working with the school is primarily toward the end of preparing men for the gospel ministry in that denomination. If other people want to attend, hey, great, that's good. And Mike has been doing the same thing. He's been involved in theological education, but it has primarily been working with one indigenous church, helping to prepare men who may be licensed or working toward licensure, or men who are working towards ordination and attending classes. Now those classes now are primarily online, but they weren't. They were face to face in the past. But nevertheless, you're thinking in terms of what will help prepare men to be ministers in this indigenous church. What does that indigenous church require for theological education of its pastors, and how can we help that church? So you can see, so the two basic ways of going and doing mission works and working theological education, as I said, either working with an institution and, you know, whoever comes is whoever comes, or working with an indigenous church and other people may come, but the goal here is to prepare men in that denomination or those denominations for the pastoral ministry. The other way, in addition to having on-site regular classes, perhaps where there's infrastructure, with a building, with a library, a physical library, on-site teachers who are there full-time, who are living there with their families. The other way would be through what we call our Mobile Theological Mentoring Corps. And this is an idea that we borrowed from the Associate Reformed Presbyterian Church. They had it. It's not exactly the same, but we morphed it. We made some rules for who we could work with and who we thought we couldn't. And you know what? We've, over the years, as we have worked in different places taking theological education, this is primarily to venues, to countries or nations where we either aren't able to put a missionary there, or maybe it would be the wrong thing to put a missionary there. In other words, you say, what, the wrong thing to put a missionary there? Well, sometimes the church has developed all of the basic things it's doing. It's self-governing. It's doing its own evangelism, so it's self-propagating, and it is self-supporting. Maybe some of the pastors are still having to work outside jobs, just like in a colonial America, where a pastor had to teach at a school and pastor a church. So maybe they're not getting full-time salaries, but nevertheless, the denomination is able to have some financial wherewithal. And so sometimes it would be the wrong thing to put a missionary in that place. Why? Because you'd be doing the things that they're supposed to be doing, or you'd be taking away from what they're doing. And so we go into those situations where we're working with an indigenous church to augment the theological education that's already there. So for instance, Camden, you went down recently to Columbia, as you've already shared on a previous show. You gave some lectures on Roman Catholicism, and particularly how Karl Rahner has influenced modern Roman Catholic theology. And you gave some classes on, based on the commentary that you wrote. And so we'll take guys down, and that will augment whatever education is already in that country for pastors by offering some additional education or some aspect to that education that might be more along the lines of an elective if you had a seminary that was able to offer courses of that nature. So those are the basic two. Those are the basic two kinds of education. So on-site and also through the Mobile Theological Mentoring Corps. But it's always in both cases, if I can come back to what you were stressing before, in both cases, our focus is how to help the indigenous church. So for instance, Camden, as you know, while we were down in Colombia, I took some time. I met with the presbytery, both men who were ministers and ruling elders, sat down. It wasn't a formal meeting, but that meeting was all about 2022, what kind of classes can we offer that are going to help you? And two of the things that they came up with were a class on the Book of Church Order, namely focusing on the form of government on the one hand and focusing on the Book of Discipline on the other. Now, that's something that you're not going to find. You're not going to find that usually in a seminary here in the United States. That's focused more on generality when it's more about the institution. But as I said, our theological education is focused on a particular denomination, working with that particular church, and what will help it equip its men to be pastors in that country.
That's, all very encouraging. And it was really helpful for me, obviously, to be on the field and see things in person. It just changes your whole perspective and broadens your view. But Charles and Mike, I suppose I'll begin with you, Charles, real quick, just to ask about your experience in the field, and maybe you can provide us a bit of a sketch and some detail even regarding the work in Uganda, but specifically that at Knox Theological Seminary and the particular type of education that's being engaged there.
Yeah, well, what I'm doing, and I really praise God for this, I'm one, two, three, four, five multiple different good missionaries and many more have been in Uganda for a long time. And I think it was about 2001, 2002 maybe, where we had, I think Tony Curto was working in the Eastern Uganda where our mission station is now, and had a school, not really a brick and mortar. Well, actually it was at first, sorry, called Westminster. And then that campus was, through some controversy, taken from us. And then so they moved to working with houses, and a particular group of men actually broke away of some church controversy. So that there's been multiple iterations and changes in what we've done there, starting with real small. And then Phil Proctor came after that and ended up purchasing some land and building some buildings, changed the name to Knox Theological College. Organized the curriculum a bit differently. And then when the next missionary came, he also kept it on the same campus. I think maybe a building was added also then. And but the thing about it was, for me, as I looked at all the different iterations of our theological training, all of it was good. All of them typically met the challenges that we had in theological education, which was language, geography, culture, a lot of things. I mean, how do you reach a certain people if you don't speak the same language? And how do you get to people if you can't, you know, if it takes 3 hours to get to a village and you have to change flat tires on the way there and one on the way back. So you have all those kinds of challenges. And at first it was small and more focused on village pastors, many of whom didn't have, weren't very literate, but they were smart enough, but they weren't very literate. So you have village pastor theological education. And then I think Phil was working in Mbale to also continue the village pastor ministry, but I think he changed it a bit. By the time I got there, many of the students were credentialed enough to get what would be called an accredited degree, but most of them were still village pastors. And so what happened when I was there is that the previous missionary had started issuing some diplomas. We were notified that it was illegal to do that. So we had to either issue certificates. This is another challenge when you're there. You know, whatever the government begins to sort of say you have to do, you have to modify and adjust. So all over East Africa, multiple parliaments, I think Burundi, Rwanda, Kenya, and Uganda has a bill right now in parliament. They sort of put it in there. And it, basically what the bills are doing is requiring every pastor who claims to be a preacher that requires them to have an accredited degree. It comes, I think, primarily from a lot of serious theological and people abused by Pentecostal, all these variations where poor people in particular are taken advantage of. They're told to sell everything and move to a mountain and God's coming in a moment and things like that. So the government was struggling with how to organize and manage that. And most of them decided pastors need to have accredited theological degrees. So with that coming down the pike, we decided that we could take Knox, which has a decent campus of several buildings. And we thought about organizing it to make it accredited, but it's very difficult, very arduous process. So therefore, we connected like a satellite campus, so to speak, with a local university, a Christian university. That worked out fairly well, but the curriculum was not reformed. It wasn't what we wanted. It wasn't the best. So when Corona hit, basically, I was just sitting there we had no churches we could meet with, no schools to meet with. Our coffee shop and book room were closed. And by the way, that's where you get some good coffee, is that coffee shop. So I was just sitting there, and I had always dreamed of, I thought, you know what, Knox, what Uganda needs, and really what East Africa needed, was an accredited reformed institution that could serve the existing reformed churches in Uganda and the multiple number of reformed churches throughout East Africa, South Sudan, Burundi, Rwanda, even Congo. We've recently had a guy from Congo contact us and saying, when are you going to get up and running? I'd like to come. So I thought, well, the governments are probably going to require it. Corona has shut me down. So I just started organizing it, started doing it. And right now, just as this hot off the press, I haven't even told Doug yet. 2 days ago, I got a notice from the new guy I've just hired. His name's Okuch, which is a great student and guy from South Sudan. we were notified that the long story short, we've gone through multiple applications and finally our applications was received, revised, and they plan to set up a Zoom type meeting where we can have what used to be an in-person meeting, but now we're going to have a meeting over sometime either in early November, I think. And then after that, they'll visit the campus. And then God willing, we will start our first independently accredited program in August of 2022.
Wow.
So excited about that.
You know, I'm going to be over there at the beginning of November, Charles.
Oh yeah.
I could sit in on that meeting personally.
Oh, that'd be great. We'd love to have you. I think at this point, originally they had planned to have an in-person meeting, but Uganda shut down still. So, okay. Which is fortunate in one way for me, because I'm stuck here in America, but I'm now going to be able to join the meeting where I originally couldn't. So that's kind of nice. But yeah, James will be on it. So we'd love to have you.
How does accreditation work? And we'll get Mike here in just a second, because he's got a lot on this subject as well, I presume. But how does what is the accrediting body? Is it the Ugandan government itself? Do they have some sort of Ministry of Education? How does that work?
Yeah, they do. They have an organization called the National Council of Higher Education, and it's it's full of what I call educrats.
They're in control of Illinois right now. Are these the same people?
Hey, man, make sure they don't listen in on this show when you call them that, by the way.
Well, they might not take that negatively, so I don't know. Well, actually, I mean, there's a couple of ways in which, you know, I used to be sort of against accreditation. I didn't like it. And then I got to the point where I guess I didn't mind it. But I was always worried that a government agency might come in and sort of try to control the curriculum. That's my baby. I want to be able to teach what I want to be able to teach, what I think is good, solid theology. But that has not been the case at all. In fact, these guys have been more concerned about the number of square meters in our latrine and where our flagpole goes. And
yeah,
those are the types of things that, how many chairs do you have in each room? Those are really exciting to them.
Yeah.
So we're trying to do, you know, they say you need one more computer in your library and three more chairs in the lounge. Doing it. But I've been able to create, I think, what is an awesome reformed theological curriculum for a diploma and a bachelor's program. And so that it's been very cumbersome. If I hadn't had Corona, I don't know that I could have. It would be hard to justify the long hours and exhausting amount of time. We've produced well over, we've been maybe, I don't know, a couple hundred pages of just documents to organize, and constitutions and mottos and all these things we have to create for it, which again is fine. We're in another country. We're trying to be submissive to what they want.
Sure.
The process has been, I think in the end it will be fine. I wish it could have been someone else, but it turned out to be me. To do it. So we worked our way through all the bureaucracy and the red tape. Yeah. And it's coming together nicely. And they haven't cared at all about our curriculum, which, in other words, they haven't tried to change anything or ask any questions that are serious that would interfere with what we want to do. In fact, I think the blessing to it, and I'll add this, is really, I notice as I look back on the history of our mission, each missionary comes in, and oftentimes a challenge of a missionary has is, what do I do and how do I do it? And so a lot of times each missionary kind of puts their own spin on something, and sometimes they start from scratch. Now that we're going to organize Knox and it'll be accredited, in fact, it'll be the kind of institution I can just hand to someone and say, you can perfect it, make it better, but you won't have to start from scratch. You're going to have something existing, a foundation, and you can build on it now. And I really think it will help whoever comes next and whoever comes out to work with us, which is hopefully anyone listening on Reform Forum. We need another teacher at Knox, and we need another.
Yeah, we're trying to recruit.
So come.
Side benefit here. Yeah, a good friend of mine, Marcus Minninger, a professor down at Mid-America, he heads up their accreditation and being around it there, as well as the Christian school where my kids attend and whatnot, even in America, it is an exceedingly tedious process. And sometimes you wonder why they care about certain things. But the goal, the hope, is that there's some measure of quality control and whatnot. But sometimes you wonder, you know, how some of these policies got in place. But Mike, I'd love to hear from you now to speak about similar topics and whatnot, but your experience in Asia in particular, out east, and your experience with seminary education and the particular struggles that you've had to endure, which are many.
Well, of course, we live in a work in a country that this is, you know, doesn't admit missionaries willingly, or at least openly.
Yeah.
And so we have to find other ways to get visas. And you know, when we have classes or seminaries, we have to always be conscious of the fact that the government could come and shut things down or close down facilities or so forth, which has happened in the not so distant future or the distant past. So that's a challenge that we have that's different than maybe in Uganda, where it's a little bit more open. But in many ways, it's very similar type of things as far as seminary education, similar to Uganda, similar to the United States, and that I am working with a seminary. If I'm asked to summarize my work, what do I do in Asia? I can summarize it by saying I'm an ecclesiastical handyman is what I describe myself as, because sort of just do all the different odd jobs that need to be done, that for one reason or another that the local pastors don't have time or ability to do very well. A big chunk of my work has been involved in credentialing. Of course, that ends up connecting with the seminary education in which I'm involved as well. That's a job that just, you know, it ends up being somewhat time consuming, and having just somebody who can sort of bring continuity to the different areas where I labor. I'm working with six presbyteries or provisional presbyteries, and so you know, you have different guys in different places who have somewhat different needs and situations, and so you have to accommodate for those things. But basically, we use the same tests and have the fundamentally the same requirements for around the country. So that's one of the big jobs that I do, and it doesn't take all of my time, but it has taken over the last seven years or so, a big chunk of it, because I've examined well over 100 men, either for licensure or for ordination, in many cases both. So looking through all those exams, listening to the guy preach, interviewing a guy, usually for licensure, you were spending 4 hours or more sitting down with them and going through their exams. And it's a little shorter for ordination. We don't have quite as much going on there, but still a fair amount of time invested in doing that. And so then through the credentialing, as you have men who have been trained and are being ordained, then they are organizing into presbyteries. There was a local pastor who put together a book of church order based on the PCAs. And I've helped with editing that and making suggestions and corrections and helping to organize the guys to discuss it and get their input and part how to improve that. So another one of my handyman jobs is helping to work on the book of church order and helping to organize these trained men into presbyteries and with churches with local sessions. And Lord willing, eventually there'll be a general assembly as well. Of course, none of that happens without theological education. There have been a number of folks with whom I've cooperated on that. And in my situation, I was not there sort of on the ground level. Other people helped organize a seminary with which I've cooperated. There are actually multiple ones with which we have some interaction, and I'll mention that here in a moment. But I have taught mostly church history, teach about one course per semester, three semesters a year. Just recently taught a class on Presbyterian and Reformed church history.
Nice.
Similar kind of content to what you get in the United States. Just not all the teachers aren't PhD holders. That's probably the big difference. We're sort of a hodgepodge of whoever we can get to teach who has some reasonable qualifications to do with the teaching in the native language. We do everything in you know, I'll say it here now, but we're in China, but we do everything in Mandarin Chinese. So some of the challenges with that is that, you know, not every book that you'd like to be able to give the students is available. In terms of my last, the class that I just taught, there's not really a whole lot on that subject. You know, there's some general church histories that you can pull little bits and pieces from here and there, and a book there and a book there. But there's not always the best book that you wish you had available to you to be able to teach those classes. Another part of my job my handyman job there is working to edit the translation of theological books into Chinese, trying to be reactive or trying to look at the books that are available and seeing things where there are gaps and trying to fill those gaps with good material. That the issue of Reformed and Presbyterian church history is one gap that in the back of my mind is something I'd like to get worked on at some point, but right now I've been busy with other things. A lot of what I've been working on has been related to sort of ecclesiology. Like I mentioned, the Book of Church Order. We actually took a book on church planting by the OPC, adjusted it for the local context and the Book of Church Order used in China, and translated that and put that out there. So there's a guide for how to do church planting from a Reformed and Presbyterian perspective and with the polity concerns that we have. Some books on training elders and deacons. For example, just one thing, recognize, David Dickinson's book, The Work of an Elder. We translated that. That's one kind of a classic text, and number of other good things. That another aspect of my work as an ecclesiastical handyman. Going back to the seminary education for just a second, Charles Jackson talked about credentialing. Of course, in China, everything is, with theological education is sort of underground, and so we wouldn't go through any kind of Chinese accreditation. But there is an accreditation agency that's sort of developing, China Association of Reformed Theological Seminary, CARTS. We're all very happy we're not based in Formosa, by the way. With CARTS, there is an attempt to develop standards for theological education cooperation with seminaries so that they can have classes which are transferred between seminaries and things like that here in the U.S. So all this stuff is under development, but a great deal of progress has been made in developing all those different areas of church and theological training, with the goal of having a solid, reformed, godly ministry, and that will be preaching and teaching faithfully the gospel and seeing churches planted throughout China, and Lord willing, also be doing foreign missions work as well at some point.
This raises so many questions that I'd like to ask, but at least a comment I'd like to make just in my experience, very brief experience a few weeks ago going down to Colombia, and then both of you brothers speaking about the Reformed people that you're working with. Many people might assume that people are just looking, they might be willing to receive help from just anyone, and it just so happens the OPC reached out and they're seeking out, willing to partner with Presbyterian and Reformed types because of that, because they were just available. But Douglas, I mean, the people that we're meeting with, they're not just interacting with the OPC, for example, or the PCA or other reform groups that are there just out of convenience. They're self-consciously and explicitly confessional. The people are desiring, if you missed it earlier, a book of church order that is coming from a Presbyterian and Reformed community. And so it's just encouraging to hear of confessionally reformed people around the world who are just in need of great help. They're in need of theological education. They're in need of books translated in their languages. They're in need of teachers and instructors in schools. And for various circumstances, they just don't have the resources that we have in the United States. But it's not because of any lack of zeal or lack of reformed or confessional identity. It's in many regards economic or just historical circumstances that have led to the current state of affairs. But these are the types of things that we're seeking to address. Douglas, has that been your experience around the world?
Yeah, if I can, and can be political as well. For instance, Mike had me come over and give some lectures on judicial cases, to sort of like it was an introduction maybe on church discipline. You're talking about people who don't want to they're not just confessing a faith. They actually want to live it. And therefore, they know that what that takes is understanding the principles. So, for instance, I said, you know, in 2022, they want somebody to come down and teach on the form of government. And I said, well, I know who I want to get down there, but I had no clue that the guy was on sabbatical next year. So I'm going to be able to take down Alan Strange to talk about form of government. And that's what he teaches with the OPC MTI class. So the advantage of that, as I explained to the presbytery down there, they don't need to have explained to them, you know, what do these words mean and what do that words mean? Because eventually they're going to develop their own book of church order. They'll develop their own form of government. What they need to understand are the Presbyterian principles that are behind that. In other words, it says what it does for a reason, because there's this global overarching understanding of the nature of the church, the nature of church office, and the way, therefore, the church needs to operate in order to work with each other. Calvin talks about this in his Institutes. The reason we have forms of government, the rules in a form of government may not explicitly be out of the Bible. Most of them aren't. But we agree that in love, these are the best rules that we need to have in order to work with each other. Well, they need to understand that principle. Why do we do what we do? And what is it in the history of the church that has led it to come to this conclusion? That's why our creeds and confessions have all grown out of some conflict that had taken place in the church, where the church is under attack, and therefore she needs to clarify her doctrine of the Trinity. She needs to clarify her doctrine of Christ. She needs to clarify her understanding of the nature of man as it's taught in Scripture. So it grows out of, you know, satanic attacks on the church of unbelief. And then, you know, one of the reasons Mike had me come over there is because although there was a Presbyterian church before, you know, the current political situation, and now there's one after, you know, during that same, it's that the church was robbed of all of her pastors for a time. I mean, you wipe out the pastors of a church, the guys who've actually had the training, and what that led to, as both Mike and more particularly Charles can share with us, that led to Unitarianism creeping into the churches of Europe. The pastors are being killed off, and so who's going to teach there? These are guys who actually are operating out of unbelief. They're coming to this, they're looking at the scriptures in a certain way, and they're saying, this is what the Bible teaches, because we don't find the word Trinity, therefore it must not really exist. Well, that's the position of unbelief reading the Bible, and that's the kind of satanic attack that has been on the church, that has been against the church from its very beginning, whether it's with regard to the nature of Christ, the Trinity, or the authority of the scriptures. So they need people with maturity, people who understand what the battles are, who will go in and say, here are the principles. Their Presbyterian church 20 years from now may look somewhat different than our Presbyterian church, but whatever it looks like, it will have grown out of them understanding the principles and applying the principles to their current needs. And so it's not just rules that they need, but it's far something far deeper than that. So just really, I think all three of us are really grateful to the Lord to be a part of that.
Mm. Charles, what's been your experience in Uganda with the indigenous church? Have you found many of these principles at work as well?
Yeah, I was thinking as Doug was talking, and I mean, and then Mike mentioned earlier, my situation in Uganda is different in the sense that maybe it's common in developing nations, but the tricky business for us is actually finding those guys with that kind of zeal.
Mm.
In other words, if I really believe this, and I hope I'm not being cynical, but I think it's true that, but if I said to someone, hey, I'll sponsor you, give you a theological education, and then I'll give you a job and we'll build you a little house and we'll build a church, and said, by the way, we're going to be Methodist, they'd say, okay.
Sure.
So there's a lot of struggle when you're in a poor, when poverty is one of the biggest issues, there's a big struggle with being committed to theological principles that may exclude help in the form of giving money or whatever. So it's a big challenge where we are to sort that out. Like as Doug was talking, I was yearning for that. I mean, where we are, it's a struggle. It's a real struggle. It's just like Mike's has to work underground where we're open. My situation tends to be people who would probably be not as doctrinally committed. Now, again, yeah, this is where theological education helps. I've sure watched it, my students as they start year one, and then as they're in when they're in year three, they're arguing again with year one students coming in because they've changed their mind, and that's really helpful. But it is a struggle. It is a very serious struggle to figure out. I mean, again, even the very guy that I think Doug was alluding to earlier, our Presbycospal friend, if it were a matter of money, I think he just would ditch the Costco stuff and become a friend. But he's struggling with that. It's sure a struggle where we are. Yeah, if that makes sense.
I mean, yeah, it does. Well,
you're dependent and you really are a needy person. If someone says, hey, you want to be a Baptist, here's everything you need to be a Baptist, I think a lot of people around me would become a Baptist. Maybe I'm become too cynical, but I think that's a struggle where we are. Yeah.
And there's all sorts of dynamics. You know, I'm no expert, but Douglas, in our conversations, just in your many years of experience, have explained to me also why the OPC does what it does the way that it does and doesn't typically, you know, seek to support a particular pastor or build buildings on behalf of a church. In large measure, just because of the practical issues that might arise regarding accountability. You know, if there's one guy who's the particular contact or the money man with an American church, the indigenous church might be much less likely to hold that guy to account for his particular views or even his personal behavior. But Mike, I was reminded of some of your work as the ecclesiological and ecclesiastical handyman, particularly in your work of translation. And just speaking about the preconditions, the necessary preconditions for education, not only to have materials in the language that people can understand, but in your case, you've also been working on a theological dictionary, if I'm not mistaken, because often we don't even have normalized names for people or places when we're not even talking about having books in the right language for the local people, but there's no agreed upon spelling, pronunciation, or term or characters to use for a lot of these topics, which leads to a whole host of other issues.
Yeah, it can be a bit of a challenge. I mean, some of the most basic vocabulary, if it's in the Bible, if it's a word, it's in the Bible, or a phrase is in the Bible, there's one Bible translation almost everybody uses. And so those terms that show up in the Protestant Bible, that's pretty standardized. But once you get beyond that, then it can become tricky. I mean, certainly things like the word for Trinity, essence versus person, these kinds of things, there are well-established terms. But once you get off sort of basic theology, get into church history, get into some more of the finer details of theology, then it becomes kind of complicated. There's a lot of times that there isn't a single term that's being used. One of the biggest headaches is names of people in church history, because
that's in English, you know, too, Mike.
Yeah, well, in Western church, well, at least in the West, we all use the Latin alphabet, right?
So, fair enough.
Regardless, yeah, whether you're in French or Spanish or right. English or German, I mean, you know, maybe there's a few funky little characters in some Eastern European, or, you know, you have Slavic languages, whatever, they have a different alphabet, but basically you still can sort of, the phonetics are close enough that you can pretty much just, Lord, transliterate, you know, character for character, and it's not hard to get something that's pretty close. I mean, it's not going to be too much variation, but when you go to Chinese, there's like a dozen characters that you could use for one particular sounds, because they can't exactly make any of the sounds in English or French or German or whatever. And then, of course, you know, you have different pronunciations in, you know, whether you look at the Greek or the Latin or the English or some other language, you know, you have to decide, well, if we're going to sort of translate this by sound, well, which sound from what language?
Wow.
So you get all kinds of different variations of the same person or name, and then it's confusing people. I mean, it seems like something's very simple, but, you know, for just one example, the Nicene Creed. Okay, yeah, that's fairly standard, but actually there's one translation, Nicaea, which is based on the Greek word, because the Greek is not ni, it's ni, right? Nicaea. There's one older Chinese is that way, and then in mainland China, someone there that they tend to want to follow the English, and so it's not Nicaea, it's Nicaea. Well, a ni and ni is totally different characters, and so people were asked the question, well, what's the difference between, is a different creed than Nicaea and Nicaea? Are they two different things? And so it's confusing. And, you know, of course, that's the case with many different people's names in Chinese, and so it just becomes complicated and difficult. If you want to have a more advanced theological education that's consistent, you know, you're going to have some sort of standardization of how you write these names and how you translate certain theological terms. Otherwise, it can be rather confusing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's something that I imagine most people never even considered, just the importance of such a thing and establishing those common terms and pronunciations and spellings, just so that we can even get to the point of a theological education. Otherwise, people might, as you mentioned, you know, spend so much time on the same subject, they don't even know they're talking about the same subject. I thought they were talking about two different things. What are things like in Uganda with this regard? What type of resources are available, Charles, and what are some of the particular needs at the moment for expanding the availability of good resources?
As far as books and so forth are concerned, the good news for me is that at least legally and in terms of use and trade, English is the language.
Yeah. So
English is the language used in instruction and classrooms. A challenge is that when someone comes to us, they don't always know English so well. I mean, they've used it, and even their educational system, they'll use English, but it's kind of a something they use. Mike mentioned pictures. I'm surprised in Uganda, a lot of people read English as if they were reading pictures. They don't read phonetically, so they don't always understand the logic and structure of a sentence and how sentences and paragraphs work. So one of the things we have to do and what we structured into our curriculum was sort of an introduction to the English language and grammar and logic and those sorts of things. So, but we don't have nearly the language challenges, especially for me. I can use English as the language of instruction. Lots of books, all the books that we require them to read are in English. The only struggle is, like I said, is that the level of English understanding it can vary a lot.
Sure.
Depending on the region you come from. And so forth. In fact, we have a student now who's just married someone whose wife didn't have 10 years of education because there was a war in her region. So schools can be shut down for long periods of time, and students can have a qualification that that doesn't matter because they don't remember what they studied. But it's a much less of a challenge, I think, for us than it is in China.
Wow. Douglas, what are things like in South America, Latin America? Where do things stand there regarding the availability of resources? And how is theological education engaged through the Mobile Theological Mentoring Corps in places where they don't understand English and we don't have enough teachers to speak in Spanish?
Yeah, thanks. When we go to places, well, first of all, as far as materials are concerned, there are some countries that have been really good at getting translations of Reformed materials. The Igreja Presbiteriana do Brasil has been, you know, it's a million member denomination in Brazil, Reformed and Presbyterian in its roots. And therefore, there's been a tremendous effort to translate books from English and Spanish, as insofar as there are books, into Portuguese. So that's available there. With regard to Spanish, there are more and more materials that are getting translated. You see things popping up all the time, new books that have been translated in, recently into Spanish. I think that, you know, and there are some good organizations like CLEAR that are doing some of that translation and some other organizations as well. So I think that that's good. Unfortunately, you know, as Mike can testify, and, you know, I'll tell you what, some of the best Christian bookstores I've ever been anywhere in the world, hands down, and that's compared to the United States, have been in China. Mm-hmm. There was, before the government closed one down, there was nothing like that, nothing like it on the face of this earth for a Christian bookstore that was full of all kinds of really good, solid reform materials that had been, I mean, they had Calvin's Institutes translated into Chinese there. So there were plenty of books. I think that, you know, but Mike, you know, what that did is the more the things get translated, that's what then, as these translations are taking place, who's doing it? How qualified are they to do it? Mike has worked with a lot of seminary students who are over here in the United States who have a little bit of time to work on getting quality books translated. But on the other hand, it's just like the Christian bookstores over here. You know, you walk into back when they actually did have a lot of Christian bookstores in the United States, you'd walk in there and what would you find? Mostly theologically Arminian material, or, you know, how to on the Christian life that's basically moralistic and not very Christ-centered, if you know what I mean, in its approach to understanding the scriptures. And likewise, just as in the United States, it seems to be that the people who we would consider to be maybe theologically and scripturally a little more impoverished seem to have more money to get their books published. It's that way all over the world. You know, people whose books we wouldn't put in anyone's hand have a lot of money, it seems, to get their books translated into Spanish or into some other language and put out there on the bookshelves. So it's not the good stuff. It's the popular stuff a lot of times that is being put into people's hands. And I want you to think about it from this perspective. Over here, you can have a mature Christian who picks up a popular book. And when I mean mature, I'm talking about a believer who's read the Bible at least several times in their life and is continued to be committed to reading the Bible regularly, who, even if they didn't grow up in a Christian family, they're a person who is self-consciously trying to figure out how to have a Christian family, and they live in somewhat of a covenantal context because they're actively involved in a church where there are other believers trying to live the Christian life. In other words, when they pick up that popular book, no matter what weaknesses might be in it, they're able to read that popular book in the bigger context of their understanding of the Bible, the confession and catechisms, and the Christian church they're part of. You take that popular book and you stick it in some other country where people aren't very literate. You know, Charles hasn't mentioned the literacy rate in Uganda is 66%. That's 1/3 of the population does not have the reading level of a 15-year-old. Okay? So even when they are reading their Bible, let's say they're reading it in English, that may be their third language. That may not even be their second language. There was this village language, and then there was this other language that's right. more universal. Mm-hmm. And then English is their second or third. And if they're reading the Bible, they're reading it very slowly, very carefully, because they don't understand the vocabulary. They don't understand the words. And they certainly don't live in a context where there is a church that has been self-consciously thinking about how a Christian lives in this world as a Christian. And now they're reading this popular book. And so rather than reading the popular book in the context of a broader, more mature Christianity, that popular book becomes the framework out of which they're going to understand everything else they're reading. So, you know, not to name names, just think of any popular book you want to out there in the Christian market and imagine that becomes the framework of the Christian life. And then you're reading Calvin in that framework rather than reading that popular book in the framework of Calvin. Mm-hmm. It's completely upside down. And we don't often think of that kind of perspective for the kind of stuff that's out there. So, the churches, for instance, in South and Central America, and there, you know, there are a couple of good, solid, you know, there are seminaries that are trying to be solid in South America, maybe one or two, but particularly in Central America, they are trying to get that stuff published, but it's still being worked on. It's not out there. The popular stuff's out there, but it's the Calvin's commentaries, the other solid books that we consider real framework books are much slower as far as they're, you know, coming to the foreground.
Yeah. I feel like we're only scratching the surface given the amount of time we've taken. It's been tremendous to keep talking. I do want to perhaps maybe ask one final question and get your take on all of these things, especially given, you know, what's happened in the United States and around the world in the last year and a half with the pandemic and just the restrictions. No matter what your particular view or take on the restrictions that exist, they exist, and they've affected foreign missions a great deal because we just can't get in and out of different countries. Douglas and I had to have a COVID test to get back to the United States, not because of the Colombian government, but the American government. Required us to have a negative test in order to get back. That's just one small, tiny little thing. But in other cases, people are not able to go into the field, and maybe not even just for the pandemic, but for governmental reasons. How has the Lord been using the internet, for example, or what opportunities exist to continue engaging in this work, even when barriers arise? This is just one particular historical manifestation of challenges to the church, but no doubt you each have seen various in your tenure as missionaries. I guess I'd just love to hear you discuss the ways, or just comment on the ways that the Lord always accomplishes His work, even when when all we can see, perhaps from an earthly perspective, are roadblocks and barriers to that work getting done.
Well, for me, that's pretty easy because, I just continued doing all the stuff I've been doing, except via Zoom, basically, just like everybody. You know, the folks in China have to use a VPN to access it, at least safely, but they manage for the most part to be able to get the software they need to be able to access it. So, like I taught this class that I mentioned on Presbyterian Reformed Church history over the internet using Zoom. I chair exams for licensure and ordination on Zoom. I join Presbytery meetings on Zoom. People call me with questions about, you know, church disciplinary matters via Zoom or other, communication software. I have been able to do the majority of my work, continuing from the United States since I left China at the end of 2018.
Charles, what have you noticed in terms of the ways in which the Lord has provided, you know, through obstacles and overcoming challenges? What are your current challenges and how might we pray for them?
Yeah, well, like I mentioned earlier, Corona moved me from dreaming about becoming accredited. And I would say from at least almost from the get-go, but at least a year into it, I kept thinking, you know what, I wish Knox could become accredited, and I wish it could be like a school where everybody in all of East Africa wanted to come for a bachelor's degree in Reformed theology. But I just didn't feel like I had the time or even the ability to do it. And there I was sitting at home, and I said, no.
Yeah.
And it turned out to be actually easier than I thought in many ways. Well, especially if you have a lot of time on your hands. But it turned out to be, I hope and I pray, and I would ask you to join us in prayer for this, because if we can get accredited, we'll be, there is a diploma and bachelor's program in Kampala, but they're down to like three guys, and they're Presbyterian. But, you know, but nonetheless, we may well be like the only and the best Reformed theological education for an accredited bachelor's and diploma degree in all of East Africa. And if that's true, and if we can get some sponsors to help students come, we may be able to, from Mbali, East Africa, educate guys from South Sudan, Congo, Burundi, Rwanda, Kenya. I just had a guy contact us from Ethiopia, too. I mean, who knows what God may do with it? But Corona made me mad, and I am glad you qualified it. We're not supposed to put our political views in here because, wow. Anyway, but nonetheless, in God's sovereignty and God's providence, I think it has enabled me to do what I only dreamed about doing, and now by God's grace, we may well do. And let me add this, too, as a prayer request. Pray for us to go through accreditation. I wanted to mention it. I structured all my classes in two-week modules so that Camden Busey and other guys like you can come over to his class, Donda.
I love it.
And I'm not kidding though. I mean, yeah. if I had my way, every Presbyterian in the OPC would take $1,000 and send a guy over every once in a while and teach a class at Knox so they could do what you did. When you went to Columbia, you experienced something you never could experience unless you went there.
Yeah.
Sounds, the smells, the sights, the bumps in the road, the way the people speak, and the food you eat, everything about it is unique. And if we could get guys to come over to Uganda, teach a two-week module, it's only a bachelor's degree, so anyone with a master's of divinity can teach classes at Knox. I think it could really engage the church in theological education. They could literally do the teaching themselves. They would experience it. They would take that vision back to our presbyteries. I think it would be a blessing for the church. But
amen.
Yeah. So 2 weeks, come to Uganda. We'll give you coffee and everything.
We love it. I'm getting all fired up already. But Douglas, I want to, of course, point people to the OPC website, opc.org, and you can link on over to foreign missions. But I wouldn't be a good host if I didn't provide you an opportunity to issue a warm welcome and maybe a recruiting pitch yourself. What are the particular needs of the Committee on Foreign Missions, and how might people pray that the Lord would provide? And you know, what types of people, specifically what types of laborers are you looking for at the moment? Maybe there's somebody listening or watching that would be pricked in their heart and in their conscience to take up this great labor.
Thanks, Camden. We do need somebody to join. Charles has just talked about guys maybe coming over for 2 weeks, but we need somebody who would go over and join him full time. This would be somebody, when we think about taking a trip, it's not just a matter of having material. You know, we've all done that, and that would be great for the 2 week thing. But it really needs to be a guy like Charles, who is able to take lectures and organize them in order to teach at sort of a community college level. Wouldn't you agree, Charles? That's about the level that you're shooting for there is like community college. But you know, that takes some organization. It's not just getting up and standing in front of people. It's figuring out where this course, what you're going to communicate in this course, and where it's going to go, and what you hope that the students will understand by the end. It has to be somebody who is culturally sensitive, in the sense that They are communicating with people for whom English is at least their second language. They probably did not grow up speaking English in their household. They grew up with Lugandan or Lugisu or Ligweri or something else, and then English was added onto that later, and maybe it's their third language, but nevertheless. So therefore, it has to be structured in such a way that it is sensitive to these are guys, and then with the respect that these are experienced guys. Some of them are already pastoring. Some of them are happy to go home on the weekend. Some of them have, how many, that one student in your class who's the pastor up at Moni, how many kids does he have, Charles? It's like,
quiverful.
A lot of them. I mean,
it's like 12 or 14 or something like that.
I mean, he's got a whole nation.
He's got a lot of kids. So these are people, these are not inexperienced as far as humanity, as far as their life in this world. These are not immature people. They're mature. This is, you're not talking to an 18-year-old. You're talking to people whose parents remember people being gunned down in the village square under Idi Amin. Okay. So their parents or their grandparents are telling those stories. That's what they remember from their childhood. So it's pretty serious, but and also a guy who has a passion to, you know, Charles is a great mentor to the students. He loves the students. You can see when he talks to the students, how much he loves them, how he interacts. And we need full-time somebody who will not just interact with the students, but be interacting with village pastors. And so that means, you know, a guy who's not afraid, like Charles during COVID, Charles and Connie are driving nurses to work. Nobody else can be on the road. They're getting a permit for their vehicle so they can take people. So it's got to be somebody who's not afraid to sometime, you know, we could tell you terrible stories about dangers over there, people being shot at, but we won't go into that. So it's somebody who wants to live for Christ and in a situation that's not always pleasant, but is beautiful and wonderful and really has great coffee. Rabina does a great job of serving coffee at Reformation Book Room. So just really love that stuff. But at any rate, it's that. So we need somebody to work with Charles down there. We need somebody to work up in a more remote area in Karamoja, somebody who will do village work, who will go out to the villages, you know, work with the men, young men who are being prepared perhaps for church office, but also be willing to go out and visit the villages. And that's not an easy thing. You know, there's different ministry, Camden, as you know, there are guys over here in the United States, they're in these huge churches. And so they don't visit anybody in their home. They expect if you need counseling, you come and make an appointment and come and meet me in my office. And they're the other kind of pastors who go out to people's houses. We need the kind of guys who will be willing to go out there. And so that'd be two guys for Uganda, one up in a more remote area and one working with side by side with Charles, with the organizational skills to teach, but also with the skills, it's the passion and the love for working with the students and the working with other pastors who need to be mentored, who want to be mentored. And that, you know, Charles talked about the challenge. You never know, is this guy really about money or is it really because he really wants to serve Jesus Christ? And even though he might start out with the former, you need to be the kind of guy who can work with him and lovingly guide him to be the latter kind of guy. Mm-hmm. Where he's there because he loves Jesus, he loves the church, and he's going to sacrifice for it. Mm-hmm. So we need two people for Uganda. It'd be great to get somebody for Uruguay, and it'd be great to get somebody for Haiti. So those are our current needs.
Yeah, amen. Well, we'll keep that in prayer, and no doubt people have listened, and there's perhaps some people out there that might be qualified and have a desire. So one way to get in touch, again, go to opc.org. You'll find contact information there.
Yeah, you can put my website in there, Camden, so they can email me.
We will, absolutely. And you can get a hold of us as well. We can connect you to the right people. We're at mail@reformedforum.org. Check us out online. You'll find all of our previous episodes, our upcoming events, and our online courses that are available for free in a variety of languages, Chinese and Spanish to begin, in addition to the English, of course. But if you have any suggestions or comments, please get a hold of us. We'd love to hear them. And be encouraged. The Lord is doing great things around the world, and we'd love more and more people to be part of that through foreign missions and just hearing about it and laboring in prayer. So we do want to thank everybody for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.